from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday in Basra, retired Lieutenant General Jay Garner called this a make-or-break month for America's rebuilding effort in U.S.-occupied Iraq. But there will be many more months, probably years, and many more chances to make or break this occupation. Tonight on Point, Occupation 101, and the enormous American challenge in Iraq now. We begin with Washington's first 4 weeks of effort in Iraq. Post-war, Baghdad fell April 9th. Today, President Bush officially named former diplomat L. Paul Bremer as his special envoy to Iraq and top administrator for the reconstruction effort there. Michael Hirsch is senior editor at Newsweek. I asked him how the early American reconstruction effort has been faring.
Well, I don't think there is a schedule. The fact is they're getting pretty bogged down. They're dealing with a lot of unknowns. What's become clear in the recent weeks since the conflict ended is that the Bush administration never really had a detailed plan for dealing with post-war Iraq. I think they had a kind of fixed mindset that once Saddam's regime was toppled, the Iraqi military and police and bureaucracy would be largely intact, the people would welcome them, and it would be, if not quite as smooth, at least a step-by-step progress to a new kind of Iraq. And instead, what they're finding is they don't know which direction they're going. It's not clear how long this is going to take, just how messy it's going to be, how long U.S. troops are going to have to be there. It's all up in the air.
Michael, let's take this from the top down, if we could. This afternoon, President Bush made the formal announcement of news that you broke about a week ago that diplomat Paul Bremer will now be in charge at the top of the reconstruction or occupation pyramid, taking over from Jay Garner as the top guy. What's the significance of this?
It had long been planned that there would be a civilian administrator of some kind. I think there's an extra urgency to this because what's happening is that the Garner mission has not worked out very well. He was supposed to be the reconstruction and humanitarian coordinator. Instead, he and his team are sort of bunkered down in Baghdad, and there's not a lot of reconstruction going on right now.
So who is Paul Bremer, and what does he bring to the party?
Bremer is a former ambassador at large for counterterrorism in the Reagan administration. He's had a 23-year career in the State Department. He's highly respected. He's viewed as a Reagan conservative who also has close ties to the traditionalists in the Republican Party, those who might be considered the moderates on the sort of Colin Powell side.
Actually has worked up until this assignment with Henry Kissinger in Kissinger's
firm. Right. He was a consultant with Kissinger Associates. And so he is, I think, seen as someone who perhaps can bridge the divide between the State Department and the Defense Department over what happens to Iraq. There have been intense behind-the-scenes battles over everything from, you know, how involved the UN should be to which Iraqi exiles should be promoted to take over to how long-term the U.S. presence should be.
So with Bremer's appointment, does responsibility for the reconstruction effort in Iraq shift from the Defense Department to the State Department? Who owns this now?
That's actually a very interesting question. It was believed that he would report to Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary. After all, the Pentagon still has, you know, technical ownership of the country. Its troops are there. But at the same time, Bush has named him to be his special envoy, which is a presidential envoy to Iraq, in addition to being the administrator of Iraq. And so, in another sense, he answers directly to the White House. So it's not quite clear. I think, again, Bremer is someone who can help to end all of this infighting in the administration that has, I think, so far paralyzed efforts.
So if we move then on down from Bremer, who will soon be presumably in Baghdad and the administrator in charge, Jay Garner has said that within a matter of days or a couple of weeks at most, there will be some kind of interim Iraqi body, Iraqi face of government. What's that to look like?
This has also been the subject of behind-the-scenes battles. The State Department has wanted to have a more inclusive countrywide Congress, sort of like the Afghan Loya Jirga at the end of that war. What this looks like is a Pentagon-led effort to get an interim authority in there quickly. One of the people involved with this new council would be Ahmed Chalabi, who was an Iraqi exile and a major favorite of some of the hawks in the Pentagon. So I think the idea is to put an Iraqi face on the occupation as quickly as possible, because what you've had in the streets in recent weeks is a lot of a backlash, incidents involving U.S. soldiers, most notoriously the shooting and killing of 17 or 18 Iraqis in Fallujah last week, and that's what they want to get beyond at this point.
But does putting a kind of face on this occupation that is Iraqi change who's actually making decisions? What does the departmental level face look like in the Department of Energy in Iraq, the Department of Health, the Department of Education? Who's now running those? Are the departments up and running at all?
Some of them are. There was a crew of Americans who were detailed to take over these various ministries, essentially run them for a year or so while installing Iraqi bureaucrats in place. This effort has not gone very far at all. We do hear that the oil ministry, at least, is being run by an American at this point. But many of the other ministries are not up and running. And, of course, this has been one of the biggest headaches, is the perception over the last few weeks that Baghdad and the rest of Iraq is just not working very well. There, you know, power just came on. It's on now, but it's been extremely hard to get provisions, to get the economy going again. Security on the roads is bad. They really need to deal with this across the board.
Michael, the message from Donald Rumsfeld, for one, seems to be patient. This is all going to work, and it's going to work fine. Jay Garner has been saying the same thing, more or less. At the same time, he says May is a make-or-break month for the U.S. efforts there. How do you assess the point at which this occupation stands right now? Is it too early to be judging? Can we already tell something about how it's off the ground or not off the ground?
I think it is too early to judge how it ends up in the long run, but I don't think it's too early to judge that in the best case, the Americans are going to have to be there for a long time. The sense that we had going into this war, the sort of neoconservative vision that we heard about, was, again, a pretty fast switchover. Iraqis delighted and overjoyed to regain control of their own country again. A fairly fast switchover to Iraqi security, where you would even have the core of the Iraqi military and police that could take over policing. That now seems a dream gone with the wind. And what you have is a ground-up nation-building type effort. It may work out in the end. There's no question that it could, but it's going to be a years-long effort by the United States.
Michael Hirsch, thank you for joining us.
Happy to do it.
Michael Hirsch is senior editor at Newsweek. He spoke with us from Washington. As night follows day in war after war, occupation follows victory. Not always, but commonly. And commonly, that occupation is longer and far more complex than the war itself. With the White House focused on homeward-bound ships at sea, many Americans have yet to focus on the massive challenge that lies ahead in Iraq. Tonight, we'll stare straight at rebuilding and the occupation ahead. Can you already feel how tough it may be? Are you? Is Washington ready for the long haul in Iraq? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Ian Lustig, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Unsettled States, Disputed Lands, Britain and Ireland, France and Algeria, Israel and the West Bank, Gaza. Good evening and welcome, Professor Lustig.
Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. So here we are. It's early days by any account, but it was April 9th that Baghdad fell. It'll be 4 weeks tomorrow since that day. Ian Lustig, you're something of a specialist in occupations. As you look out at the early signs, the early trajectory of this one, how do you assess it? Are we off on the right foot here? What's your early assessment?
Well, we're off on a typical foot. Typically, what you've got in an occupation, the reason it exists is there's a tremendous asymmetry of power that leads one dominant state into a weaker area, like a vacuum pulls in a force. But that asymmetry is matched on the other side by an asymmetry of knowledge. The occupying power knows much, much less about what it's occupying than the people who actually live there. So that results in a whole series of possible pathologies. And we can see right away that the thing we worried about most, the threat we worried about most, weapons of mass destruction, we were wrong about. It wasn't a threat. And the thing we faced, the biggest problem we're facing now, is the thing we never imagined, namely looting, instability, inability to quickly put a country working, a working country together. So that's that's kind of typical of this asymmetry of knowledge and some of the problems it will cause down the road.
Jay Garner is very upfront about that. If there were some surprises in the war, he has been quoted saying there are many surprises coming out of the war, that the United States, as you say, expected weapons of mass destruction to have been used, expected a very widespread and large-scale displacement of Iraqis and a refugee problem. And above all, Jay Garner was hoping to convert maybe 100,000 Iraqi soldiers into the ground troops of an occupation force for the U.S. Instead, they just melted away. So I guess surprise is the number one thing that comes with an occupying power's inauguration of that occupation?
Well, you might remember the first couple weeks of the war when Secretary of Rumsfeld responded to questions about wasn't he surprised by various encounters in Nasiriyah, difficulties, setbacks. He said, no, we plan for surprise because there's a fog of war. Well, it's the fog of politics, the fog of nation building is actually much denser and less penetrable than the fog of war. And I think that that's the challenge. I think your first interview tonight showed that the way that we are now much less prepared for building not only a nation but a state, and those are different things, mm-hmm. than we were for actually breaking the state that was there.
And Lustig, I want to deal with one semantic thing right at the top here. The administration is very resistant to the word occupation. They like to talk about rebuilding, like to talk about reconstruction, but not occupation. In previous wars, the United States didn't shrink from that. There was an occupation of Germany, an occupation of Japan, and others. What's your sort of technical, formal assessment? Is this a military occupation that is now underway in Iraq?
Well, that is a semantic issue, and it's a propaganda question, of course. We talked about our occupation of Germany and Japan. We have drawn back, for example, from talking about the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, preferring to talk about those as disputed areas. This is more of a political question. Legally, if you ask, even take the Supreme Court in Israel, or presumably the United States, if it gets around to saying what its legal right to exercise authority over Iraqis is, it's the rights of a belligerent occupant in international law. That is, there are certain laws concerning belligerent occupation that during a war caused for whatever purposes, if you are then in charge of the territory as a result, whether you were attacked or you did the attacking, you are a belligerent occupant and you have certain rights and responsibilities under those laws.
Which makes the U.S. that occupying power. Now, when you look out across the history of occupations, and we're going to talk about some of those tonight, but are there models, are there forms, are there examples that you would point to as being like or unlike the challenge that the U.S. faces now in Iraq?
Well, I think many people think about Germany and Japan as models of our occupation talents. But the big difference there is, besides the difference between Germany, Japan, and Iraq, is that the entire Japanese government, for example, was wholly intact, handed itself over to us under the rule of their emperor, who we allowed to stay in power. The top leader was just a strata of war criminals, more or less, or high-level military officers that were removed. So the country kind of went forward into a reconstruction phase. Not a single American soldier was ever shot at or resisted.
Douglas MacArthur ensconced himself right across from the emperor's palace, and off they went.
That's right. And more or less the same thing in Germany, because we allowed so many ex-Nazis to maintain their positions in the government. They were experts, technocrats, government officials, white-collar people who were in the Nazi Party. The de-Ba'athization of Iraq is, you know, that's a challenge to us, but it also would run into the problem of, do we give up on the possibility of building a coherent state apparatus in Iraq? Do we have to do it from the ground up? In Germany as well, there was no resistance whatsoever once the surrender took place. So we weren't really in the kind of situation we are in Iraq, which is more like, I would say, our occupation of Cuba or the Philippines during the Spanish-American War.
Reaching a century back.
Right. And we see that, you know, the experience of Cuba is not that happy. We took over Cuba with the idea of bringing democracy there, and we did occupy Cuba for a period of time. In fact, several different occupations, because the governments we installed there either turned out to be too corrupt or too weak to last very long.
And we ended up with revolution, and in the Philippines, hundreds of thousands of dead. Ian Lustig, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about America's challenge in Iraq now. Occupation 101. You can join the conversation. Do you have the appetite to focus on Iraq's rebuilding? And if you don't, will Washington? Should the United States dig in for the long haul or get out of Iraq ASAP? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's challenge in Iraq now, really about sort of a short course, Occupation 101. You can join the conversation. Where do the first weeks of American control suggest to you this is all headed, and how can we draw on history in assessing the challenge in Iraq? What models are relevant? Japan, Germany, Algeria, Lebanon, Cuba, the Philippines. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, joining us from Lower Merion, Pennsylvania, is Ian Lustig, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Unsettled States, Disputed Lands, Britain and Ireland, France and Algeria, Israel and the West Bank, Gaza. He's made studies of many occupied countries and occupying powers around the world. Tonight we're looking at the United States in Iraq. Ian Lustig, just before the break, you said let's not look at Japan and Germany, those post-World War II occupations, but rather way back to Cuba and the Philippines. In a way, those are code. What does that suggest about when you bring up those instances? What does it suggest we're up against in Iraq?
Well, one of the problems that we are up against is that we're a democracy, and democracies are not made to be occupying other countries. Empires are made to do that. They're organized from the top down. And they go into a foreign country and they find a leader, they make him the leader, and he's the leader from the top down. But when you're a democracy and you go and rule another country, the people in that country look at you and they try to model themselves after you, and that means deciding yourself who your government ought to be and not taking the leader that's chosen for you. So when we go into the Philippines or Cuba and perhaps into Iraq, we want our kind of government there. We don't want a militarily strong government. We don't want an anti-Israel government. We don't want a too Islamist a government. On the other hand, we're also saying we want a democracy, which is to say we want the people there to choose their leadership. So we're generally caught in a dilemma whether we want to allow events to go forward there that would produce a democratic regime, but not in a way we might like. Or do we try to control what happens, but perhaps plant the seeds for big unpleasant surprises later and the likelihood that whatever regime develops there will not survive our departure?
So how didactic can the U.S. be? How much can it go in and teach, guide, compel? Donald Rumsfeld has already said that there will not be an Islamist government in Iraq. Well, we'll see. But in this circumstance, of course, as you well know, the United States wrote the Constitution for Japan. Can the U.S., can Washington go into Iraq with that kind of writ to design things, to architect things from the ground up and accomplish it?
I don't believe it can. There's really two learning curves that we have to think about. One is the unlearning curve. We have to unlearn many of the extravagant expectations that brought us to Iraq. Earlier in the program was mentioned the neoconservative group, the Project for New American Century, and the Pentagon, and so on, that had a very elaborate idea of how Iraq was but one step on the road to a grand neo-imperial vision of democracy, American style, sweeping across the Middle East and elsewhere.
I'd have to say that vision's still alive, at least rhetorically.
I believe it is. And so was the Israeli vision, for example, when they went into Lebanon in 1981 to replace the government in Lebanon with a Maronite pro-Israel ally and then use that as a fulcrum to transform the Middle East. Problem is that their favorite fellow was assassinated very quickly, and his brother, who came into power, basically told the Israelis, no deal. And Israel took that. That was the unlearning curve.
And they spent 18 years
there.
It ended up being described as Israel's Vietnam.
Out of Lebanon, and that they could not actually control that country or use it as a fulcrum for moving toward grander ambitions. So I say that we have two learning curves, and we can't really start the important one, that is how to build, help a society evolve. Let's not think of building something. Let's create the conditions under which a healthy country can evolve, even if that country will reject much of what we would like, rather than thinking we are going to build some kind of Pinocchio you know, in our image or some fantasy that we have of an Iraq that could really never exist.
And yet, boy, oh boy, that's right in the middle of the president's promises, the president's language, Donald Rumsfeld's and everyone else's so far. I want to look a little more closely at the Lebanon example that you raise. And Lustig, if you'll stand by, I want to welcome into our conversation Asad Abu Khalil. He joins us from San Francisco tonight. He's a professor of political science at California State University Stanislaus. Good evening and welcome, Asad Abu Khalil.
Good evening to you.
Thanks for joining us. Your family was in Lebanon at the beginning of the Israeli occupation there. You watched firsthand as that occupation matured and finally failed with the Israelis withdrawing. What was that experience like? What did you and your family, what did Lebanon, what did Israel learn from it, Asad Abu Khalil?
Well, I think that Ian is right about the challenges that are facing the United States in Iraq. But I think that one can learn, in fact, from his own book, that democracies manage to adjust to a situation of occupation, even if it's a brutal one, whether the Israeli case against the Palestinians or the British one against Northern Ireland. And I think what happens in that case is, because democracies have such a high self-image of themselves, they just have a hard time accepting that another people will not find their own occupation to be pleasurable and enjoyable. They think just because we're a democracy, I mean, they must love us because of that.
We're so great, we're so principled, you've got to love what we're bringing you.
Well, yes, I did basically barely survive the Israeli invasion of Lebanon of 1982, and the first few days in June of that year, the Israelis, in response to what was really a pretext for them, attacked Lebanon in a very massive bombing. And because the apartment building where my family lived, and I lived with them, we had to relocate. My family went to one part of the city of Beirut, and I chose to go with my aunt in South Lebanon.
But you describe in the early days of that occupation many people welcoming the Israelis. There had been an awful lot of exploitation and violence with the Palestinian groups there,
right,
and there was kind of the equivalent of the hosannas in the street that we saw a bit of in Baghdad.
No. This is where the analogy ends, I think.
Mm.
One of the things that was very clear to me, and to be honest with you, I was not happy with it, is that many southern Lebanese, the people I am a part of,
yes,
were in fact glad that the Israelis came. And it is because they wanted to rid themselves of the kind of thuggery that existed in South Lebanon due to the militias, Lebanese and Palestinians, that roamed the streets and abused their power and really terrorized the population. And the Israelis were, and of course, people were also very unhappy about the clashes between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and often the Israelis bombed indiscriminately areas of South Lebanon, so they thought this would be the end. But people should understand the attitudes of people towards occupiers after an occupation are tinged with a lot of fear and intimidation.
You mean after it begins?
After it begins.
Mm-hmm.
What they say and do often is not the genuine feeling. I can tell you that, I mean, I watch Arabic TV on my satellites as well as American TV, and I noticed in Iraq what people say through the American reporters or the British reporters, through translation or in English, is so much different what they are telling in the first even few days of the occupation of Iraq to the Arabic reporters. They tend to be much more critical of the Americans, very much hostile to the occupation.
Well, we hate to hear those words. You're saying we're getting a kind of a smiley face, a kind of put-on face already. Of course, in this example of Israel and Lebanon, it ended up being a long, painful, bloody, downward spiral to their eventual withdrawal. When you look at the early days of the American invasion and occupation of Iraq, Asad Abu Khalil, what's your gut telling you here? Can we pull this out?
Right. Well, my feeling is, I mean, if I were to advise the U.S. government, which I do not, and I don't think they're interested in my advice anyway, I would say that if the United States really want to gain the goodwill of the people of the Middle East and even the world, the best thing they would do, in fact, if I were them, because Iraq is a mess, and we now know how little they knew about Iraq. They relied on the advice and opinions of people who have never been in the country or who gave them false advice because it served their political interest. I'm talking about the people, the corrupt people of the Iraqi National Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is very surprising to all of us watching the Middle East, I think, is the depth of the Islamic fundamentalist factor in Iraq. Not only among the Shiites, but even among the Sunnis, these are the most potent forces. The United States had no idea about that. If the United States want to gain the goodwill, I think, they would surrender the country and its government to the United Nations or to some international force. And then they would leave and tell the Iraqis, we have no interest in oil and we don't want to colonize you or subjugate you. That would be a tremendous move that would have a domino effect that would create such different attitudes to the United States. But I'm certain it's not going to happen. The United States is going to arrogantly try to subjugate the Iraqis and try to fashion a government to their own liking. And that is going to run against what the people have in mind. And what is very different from the Israeli case, in my opinion, I am very much surprised how early the Iraqis are fashioning anti-occupation, anti-colonization attitudes consistently in various parts of the country. That, for the United States, will bode ill for the future. It indicates that, in fact, an anti-occupation force, peacefully and then militarily, will be mustered in shorter period of time than that took place in South Lebanon against the Israelis.
And yet, Ayin Lustig, anyone of goodwill has to wish this effort well. Assad Abu Khalil says, U.S., get out of there and get the U.N. in. Washington has said, let's not get involved in all that occupation by committee that the U.N. represents. We want to hand this over to an Iraqi government just as soon as possible and do away with that interim step. What's your advice?
Well, I think Assad is right about that. I think some kind. The United States didn't want to go in under an international umbrella. It doesn't now want to go out because it's still caught up in the same, in my view, fantasy about what it can do there. But when we get through that unlearning curve and start the learning curve, we're going to need more than we realize now that international umbrella and probably somebody to hand off Iraq to. Remember, we dealt with the end of an occupation recently, the end of the occupation of East Timor, and that's been moving ahead quite well, actually, under a United Nations trusteeship.
But that was a much more docile nation and government in waiting. Why would the United Nations, Ayin Lustig, be more successful than the superpower United States?
Well, it's much less of a target. Whatever we establish there, because of the history of Western imperialism in the Middle East, because of our attitude stated and otherwise towards Muslims and towards Middle Easterners, any government that is set up under our auspices will experience problems. Any government experiences problems, but that government will be then attacked for not solving these problems because it's the stooge of the Americans. And therefore, as soon as we put our imprimatur on a regime, it's almost a kind of kiss of death. It dooms that government to have to fight battles it can never win, proving that any time it runs into a difficulty, it's not because it was set up illegitimately.
So when will we know that we're on what you call the learning curve as opposed to what you call the unlearning curve you say we're on now, Ayin Lustig?
Well, when there's some more relationship between what the what our people in Washington, our leaders, are saying and what events on the ground are showing us, I think that one of the theme of this program is what does American occupation do to Iraq? What should our policies be? How can this occupation affect Iraq for good or for ill? But one of the things that is most important to remember about occupations is that they affect the occupier also. That one of the things that happens is governments, in order to maintain or cover up the errors that they realize that they have made, start to deprive their publics at home in the democracy of the information and candid reporting of what's actually happening that is needed for the public to act sensibly. In other words, it's fundamentally a problem that democracy is inconsistent with imperialism. Democracy at home can be undermined by the need to maintain a false image of what's happening overseas and protect it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ayin Lustig, Assad Abu Khalil, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation, joining us from Bethesda, Maryland tonight, Thomas Donnelly. He's a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, specializing in national security and defense. Good evening and welcome, Tom Donnelly.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Tom Donnelly, we're getting a rather worried picture of the U.S. effort to support a transition to democratic government and reconstruction in Iraq tonight from our two guests so far. What's your view of how this thing has begun and its chances for success, its best path to success?
Well, you'll not be surprised to learn that I disagree with the other two guests.
We're hungry for another view.
Well, I was one of the former chief fantasists for the Project for the New American Century, so...
Chief fantasist.
I'm still betting on the force of individual liberty. If you ask me to bet my mortgage one way or the other, I think we'll be able to succeed, and I think we've well begun, and I think a lot of the historical and other examples that the other two participants have given are not accurate portrayals. And
So paint the chain of events, the train of events that you imagine that will lead to a more positive outcome. We're really hungry to see that picture.
Well, right. I think naturally this appeals to any American point of view. We believe that our version of political freedom and liberty is, in fact, a universal political right enjoyed by every human being everywhere, regardless of race, creed, or color, nationality, or what have you. So Americans are sort of bound to believe that our version of political liberty is something that should have appeal to people.
So are you saying sprinkle on the elixir of individual liberty and Iraq will, not without effort, but somehow kind of chemically respond to that in a way that conforms to democratic standards, to a free market structure?
Well, it turns out that these ideas have a pretty broad appeal, not only in Iraq, but the naysayers have been saying for decades that these are, in fact, Western values that are culturally determined, don't appeal to, say, Confucian cultures, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out, in fact, that there are a whole host of vibrant and growing and even raucous democracies in East Asia that didn't used to exist 10 years ago. So, again, if you take one step back from the headlines of the moment and you look at the general course of history, say, over time, then I think you'd have to say that the combination of American power and American principles has been relatively successful through history.
Mm. Asad Abu Khalil, we have a short time before the break, but I want to get your response to Tom Donnelly here.
Well, I must confess that I really squirm when I hear the invocation of the words liberty and freedom these days, because I think people use them only to mean not true freedom for the people of Iraq, but basically the freedom for America to run its own course inside the country. I mean, if we really believe in the Iraqi right to freedom, and I don't believe it's culturally determined, I don't believe it's incompatible with the Iraqi political culture, but I think the Iraqis are making it very clear in Friday's sermons, in speeches, and in political parties, they want to be free of American occupation and subjugation. And I also want to say, I mean, with this language of liberation of countries and so on, I mean, take Afghanistan, which many Americans are under the false impression it was free. I mean, if anybody believes there's freedom in Afghanistan, they should take another look. The country is run by thuggish, brutal warlords. And in fact, the people are not enjoying their rule to the point that those fanatic Taliban may be regrouping and may be back in power sometime soon.
Well, look, I have to interject here. Assad is a guy who believes that the Arab press, the state-controlled Arab press, is a more accurate portrayal of the truth than
that's not true.
The competitive. Like, it's what you just said earlier, so I'm simply quoting what you said.
You're quoting me wrong.
You're wrong about Afghanistan. I don't know where you're getting your information about Afghanistan, but there's progress, real progress being made all over the country. And your information about Iraq is simply wrong. The Iranian-sponsored clerics tried to turn the expression of genuine religious feeling in Karbala into an anti-American rally, and it was a spectacular failure.
Tom Donnelly, Asad Abu Khalil, Ian Lustig, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's challenge in Iraq, now about Occupation 101. You can join the conversation half a century after victory in World War II. Does Washington still have what it takes to rebuild another country, to build a democratic Iraq? What's the best you're hoping for in Iraq? What's your worst fear about America's involvement there? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight, Ian Lustig, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, Asad Abu Khalil, professor at Poli-Sci at California State University in Stanislaus, and from Bethesda, Maryland, Tom Donnelly, research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. You can join us as well. Ian Lustig, I want to turn to you. Tom Donnelly was saying just before the break, let's not underestimate the power of individual liberty here. Set it loose in Iraq, and it will be a powerful engine for the reconstruction of that country. And what I'm reading and what he says is that Iraq will build a democracy on the back of that fundamental seed.
Well, as he said, he was one of the fantasists. And this notion that the principle that we all honor, that people want freedom, that somehow that translates into steady progress towards stable democracies that are peaceful, We can show with our own history that that's just not sufficient. The United States, I'm sure Mr. Donnelly would agree, back in the, if even going back to the 19th century, was filled with people, North and South, who loved liberty. But that didn't prevent a violent, horribly bloody civil war from breaking out on our shores, 600,000 people dead. It didn't prevent us from engaging in a couple of pretty aggressive wars of conquest, thinking of the Mexican War and the Spanish-American War. So you just can't count, not only on the United States, but anywhere, of thinking that it's enough to say that everybody's equal, they're human beings, they want liberty, and therefore they'll build a country like we have, and they'll do it peacefully, and they'll do it in a democratic fashion. That assumes some kind of theory of state building that we don't have, and it assumes, and I'd ask Mr. Donnelly, what historical precedents of countries anything like Iraq and occupiers anything like the United States would he point to as a success? He said that our examples weren't historically correct. Please give me an example that he thinks is a hopeful one for his opponent.
I would say that your own reading of American history is entirely opposite of mine. Any country that's willing to shed blood on the scale of our own civil war and then to spend the next 100 years reconstructing Southern society in order to enforce the notion that every American citizen enjoys fundamental political rights strikes me as a perfect example of a bunch of guys who have what it takes to stick through some pretty difficult times in order to achieve the political ends that we all believe in. I mean,
so, Tom Donnelly, you're saying if the U.S. could sustain its own civil war
of American, strength of will and character and willingness to sacrifice to achieve, to realize the political principles that are our founding ones.
Tom Donnelly
showed us that we had a willingness to sacrifice, but it also showed that eventually we figure out that when we make a mistake, the fact that we made sacrifices is not necessarily proof that we ought to go forward with
Tom Donnelly, I want to ask you a more contemporary question, if I may. How do you square the United States giving liberty and the democratic goal to Iraq with the freedom to determine its own future with Donald Rumsfeld's statement that there will not be an Islamist government in Iraq? What if Iraq wants that?
A theocratic government is ipso facto not a government that is going to guarantee political liberty to individual citizens.
And yet, what if Iraq should choose a theocracy?
That is precisely what the Secretary says. We are not going to sit still for a government that doesn't respect the rights of its own citizens.
But what if that's at odds with the will of the Iraqi people, however that might be expressed?
We're not going to have a one-time vote that installs another dictatorial regime.
Let me say something here, because again, what we think we know about the Middle East and what is actually known are two different things. There's a big difference between a theocracy, a one-man, one-vote, Iran-style mullah government, and in allowing Muslim political parties to participate in free elections. Most of the democracies in Western Europe started out and still have Christian parties in them, Christian democratic parties.
But presumably Donald Rumsfeld is not opposed to that notion.
Well,
he hasn't said so anyway.
I'm sorry. What I hear him saying is that we will not allow Islamist, which simply means Islamic parties, from participating because they might turn out to be something that we don't like or which we think would be dangerous. I would be perfectly happy for a rule that said that parties that don't accept the outcome of elections should not be allowed to run, but parties that do should not be barred because they make religious appeals.
Because they have an Islamic
Western
connection.
European democracies, including our own democracy, are filled with political parties that make Christian and other... Israel is a great example. It's a country where there's no separation of synagogue and state.
It's right in the middle of the very founding. I've got a lot of callers who have been holding at bay. If you'll let me call them in, I'd appreciate it. Michael's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You've been patient on the line.
Yes, hello. Looking back at historical precedent, the denazification of Germany and its equivalent in Japan were largely short-circuited when we needed those countries, or in the case of Germany, the western part of the country, on our side during the Cold War. The punishment of war criminals in Japan largely ended with North Korea's invasion of the South. And in fact, as far as intelligence services go, we never denazified the German intelligence service because they were too good at penetrating the Soviet.
Let's pull together pronto against the Reds, in other words.
Right. And the question is, we're now occupying Iraq, and Iran is still our enemy. It's at least half of their government
right.
are.
Axis of evil.
And we now have control of a country and a lot of people who are very good at fighting Iranians, or at least have done it before.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, how is that a possibility in our future of Iraq basically being our man on the spot?
As the bulwark against Iran, Michael, thanks for your call. Interesting question. Assad Abu Khalil, what's your assessment? Are we likely to see Iraq turned into a bastion against Iran and with a kind of embrace of Ba'athist structures in order to do that?
I see the reverse, in fact. I see the United States unintentionally creating, instead of what the United States consider to be a member of the axis of evil, to a sphere of influence for Iran that is ever-expanding. And if anybody, I mean, just to show you that the fantasy about the future analysis of Iraq continues and it expands. I mean, that's how they analyze the rise of Shiite fundamentalist forces in south and in the city of Baghdad. They say, well, this is Iranian intervention and agent. I mean, does anybody honestly believe that the 2 million people who showed up in Karbala with slogans against Ahmad Chalabi and the INC and against the occupation and against Saddam Hussein, these are really controlled by the Iranian government? I mean, if they really think that, they are about to have more surprises ahead of them in the future. I mean, I think that the United States is serious about having democracy only as a slogan against countries that it doesn't like. For countries that do what they are told, like Egypt, Jordan, Israel, and Morocco, if they do what they are told and they follow American foreign policy, they can do anything they want with their people, occupy, persecute, and in fact torture.
Well, maybe, but we're told that's not the new way. I want to get one more call in here. Peter's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
I had several comments. One is, I think that I think it was Mr. Lustig who
yes.
said that occupation, he doesn't know of any examples of successful occupation. I think that the...
I'm not sure he said that.
No?
Not a blanket. I mean, Japan and Germany presumably were successes.
That's what I was going to raise.
And yes.
Secondly, before getting to my main point,
yes.
I think the word occupation is not simply a matter of politics, but a term which is used when your only claim to a certain territory is as a belligerent, a successful belligerent, that mm-hmm. is, as a conqueror. If you have another claim based on something else, as for example...
Liberation, for example?
No. For I was thinking, of course, of Israel's claim based on the Palestine Mandate, which is in Article 50 of the UN Charter, which accepted all of the mandates... left over from the League of Nations. That is a prior and it's a claim that exists whether or not Israel won the territory.
Peter, we've got it, and my time is running down, but we clearly see everybody wants to duck that term occupier. Ayn Lustig, we've heard from Assad Abu Khalil and Tom Donnelly on their prescription more or less here, but we haven't heard yours. If you were advising the Bush administration tonight, what would your advice be? You know what they've got in their laps? What should they do with it?
Well, first thing I tell them to do is break down the walls of the silo in the Pentagon that's preventing the best minds in our government from getting the information about what's going on in Afghanistan and Iraq into the hands of the top decision makers.
Does the Paul Bremer appointment mean that they've done that today?
They've done that, yes. Under Douglas Feith, there's an organization that tries to prevent and control any information from moving into the White House that is contrary to the fantasies that have been spun for it.
We've got 30 more seconds. What else?
The idea that Afghanistan is just going forward wonderfully is a perfect example of that. That's number one. Number two is we did mention the idea that as we move forward and we start going through the unlearning curve into the learning curve, we're going to have to start getting the UN involved, start moving toward a handoff to an international trusteeship. And our role in that trusteeship will diminish, I hope, rather rapidly. The extent to which we can make that handoff work will be the extent to which we can actually look forward to an Iraq that we can live with in the future.
Ian Lustig, that's going to have to be it for tonight. I hope we can have you back to follow this as it goes forward. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Assad Abu Khalil and Thomas Donnelly, thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Ian Lustig is at the University of Pennsylvania, Assad Abu Khalil at California State University, Stanislaus, and Thomas Donnelly is a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point. The recently completed war with Iraq had several similarities with the 1991 Gulf War. Both lasted only a few weeks. Both saw Saddam Hussein's forces defeated. But one key difference was that despite George W. Bush's talk of coalition in Gulf War II, U.S. troops went into Iraq without the overwhelming international support they had in 1991. Former Secretary of State James Baker was the architect of the coalition in the first Gulf War. Speaking last night at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston, Baker said it is vital that America remains committed to multilateral international efforts. But there are times, he said, when the United States must go it alone. Here are excerpts from last night's speech by James Baker.
I don't care whether you were for the war or against the war, and there was plenty of reason to debate both sides of that issue going in. I don't think many people will argue with the success of the war, or really will argue from a moral standpoint with whether or not we've done the right thing. We have done the right thing. This was a more difficult war to bring the international community together behind because it was a preemptive or preventive war. More so, for instance, than what we did in the first Gulf War, even more so perhaps than what was done in Kosovo, not more so than what was done in Panama and in some other instances. And I think we have to keep in mind that multilateralism is good in some situations, but unilateralism is also good in some situations where the national interests of the country require it. The surest and best test of a great power is the ability to act unilaterally if indeed the interests of the country require it. We need friends and allies around the world. We have relied upon, and very satisfactorily so, a number of alliances and organizations throughout the last 40 years, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization for one. And it's important that we reconstruct those alliances, that we maintain those alliances. But in doing so, I think it's also important to understand that reconciliation is a two-way street. We had some differences with France and Germany and Russia, and we need to find a way back on track with those countries. But reconciliation is a two-way street, and they need as well to come toward us. And one way to do that would be not to object to the lifting of sanctions on the Iraqi people. There's nothing wrong with our expressing our disappointment about what happened in the divisive debate over that second resolution. We can express that disappointment both in words and in deeds, but we can't let that disappointment cloud our judgment as far as the long term is concerned. It is important that we maintain these alliances and that we reconstruct them. When you consider the community of interest that we have with particularly these three countries, France, Germany, and Russia, trade interests, interest in fighting the war on terrorism globally. So there's nothing wrong with showing our disappointment both by word and by deed, but we need to ultimately get back on track.
Former Secretary of State James Baker speaking last night at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.